It is 1:05 p.m. and it is Wednesday, April 20th. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of meetings, and Talia Ames.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:05 p.m. and it is Wednesday.
Never had that happen.
Do you need a brief at ease? Brief at ease. Back on record, Representative Drummond, we're getting a big echo, and the suggestion is that you should mute your teams.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Drummond.
I'm not on teams. I was not sent a link. I would love to be on teams, however. Thank you. I'll stay on the teleconference line.
Well, the echo seems to have gone away. We'll pause for just a minute.
Thank you. I'll mute myself.
Well, I'm not hearing the echo anymore. So at this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in there to please silence your cell phones and whatever technology was echoing. It seems to have silenced itself without our doing anything else. Present today, we have Representative Vance, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond is on teleconference. My vice chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Klayman, we have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 331, Self-Storage Units, Lien Sales, sponsored by Representative Tuck. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Today, I'd like to continue questions. I'll note for the committee that we have three individuals online to provide opening remarks before questions. Daniel Bryant, the legal and legislative counsel for the Self-Storage Association, calling from, I want to say, Louisiana. Sharon Beeman, manager of Forbes Storage LLC in North Pole, on teleconference. And Elizabeth Mann, property and marketing manager, Global Finance and Investment Company, also on teleconference. And we'll start with Mr. Bryant. If you want to provide some remarks, and I recognize Representative Tuck joined us just a few minutes ago. Mr. Bryant.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Bryant, and I'm legal and legislative counsel to the Self-Storage Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 331 today. As I testified last hearing, Alaska is the last remaining state without a self-storage-specific lien statute. The Self-Storage Association believes these laws are essential to ensure that owners understand exactly how the lien enforcement process should work from the moment the rental agreement is executed through default and sale. House Bill 331 would protect businesses by allowing them to rely on a process established by the legislature rather than relying solely on the terms of their contracts with consumers. Additionally, these laws provide and ensure minimum protections for consumers in the state. With the storage-specific lien law, consumers are guaranteed essential protections like direct notification of their default. Self-Storage Association believes that a basic statutory structure should exist to control fundamental elements of the process, and therefore we request committee support for House Bill 331. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I would certainly be happy to answer any questions.
And I'll once we get to questions, just be available because we'll let committee members ask whoever would like to ask. Ms. Beeman, did you want to add any opening comments before we go to questions in a little bit?
No additional comments at this time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mann, did you want to make any comments before we get to questions?
I do have a couple of concerns with the House bill, but if I have time to talk about that later, then I will wait.
Okay, well, wait. Representative Tuck, did you want to make any opening remarks before we turn to questions, or your staff?
No, I just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill additional time. Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, District 23. And as was pointed out earlier, we are the only state that doesn't have a storage lien bill or statutes on the books. Even Puerto Rico, I believe, has storage lien laws. This operates much the same way as the Landlord-Tenant Act. It's basically agreements between consumer and the storage lien. I mean, sorry, the storage owners. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And did you want to have your staff add any remarks at this point? Not required, just.
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, through the chair. I just wanted to point out to address some of the concerns that were brought up at the previous meeting. And the one of the people that testified that is an actual storage facility owner had a really good suggestion on how to deal with the restricted property that was discussed, and that's the firearms. So currently, the way the bill is written, the restricted property would be turned over to a law enforcement agency, and then there's a process laid out where the owner of the restricted property could basically apply to the law enforcement agency for the return of their property. Based on the testimony we received at the last meeting, the sponsor's office has submitted a request to Legislative Legal to have an amendment drafted to change the way the bill addresses firearms under the restricted property section of the bill. Instead of turning over guns and ammo to a law enforcement agency, a facility owner could have a local law enforcement agency check the serial number to make sure that the gun is not stolen, and then if not, it could be returned to the facility owner and would become subject to the storage lien. This is more in line with what the Self-Storage Association had been lobbying for and seems to be in line with the way many of the storage facility operators deal with the firearms when they're part of a facility that is turned over.
Thank you. Okay, that
brings us to questions from members of the committee. Any committee member questions? Representative Snyder.
Mr. Chairman, if I could start with one just statement. I had put in a request to Ledge Legal on a question that I had, and I thought I might share it.
Okay.
I was just concerned. I didn't think it was actually going to be an issue, but wanted to confirm that the, I'm going to use the right terms here, the value limit provision, I wanted to make sure did not have some inadvertent impact on should the whatever was inside a storage unit, should it end up being sold, would not adversely impact what happened to those proceeds if those proceeds were greater than the value limit set. And no, it doesn't. And I think you all probably knew that, but just for my own clarification, that was confirmed for me. And just simply because it's been a...
Can you explain that again? I
didn't understand. So let's see. I will...
And Representative Kirka joined us. It's 113. Please proceed, Representative Snyder.
So I had sent in for a memo to make sure I understood. I wanted to ensure that the value limit in a rental agreement didn't prevent a storage unit renter from collecting excess disposal proceeds from the value limit when the contents of the storage unit were sold. So when you rented out a unit, the owner may put a value limit on what can be kept in the storage unit. And then in the event that an owner went MIA, could not be located and the contents were sold, if the contents were sold for a value that exceeded the stated value limit in the contract. I just wanted clarity on if there were any implications on what the owner could then collect once they were notified, if they were notified, and there's no relationship. And I figured as much, but I just wanted to confirm.
Just so that would mean if the contract said you can't, don't put more than $10,000 worth in the storage unit, and then the renter disappears, and then they sell the storage contents, and it turns out that they're worth $15,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then when the renter comes back and said, give me the value of my property, and they're not capped at $10,000, they could still get the $15,000 less whatever fees were associated.
Correct. Right. Correct.
Is that consistent with the bill sponsor's understanding?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck through the chair, I believe so. I just wanted to point it out. The section is on page 7, lines 6 through 9, section 34.35.665. But that's my understanding as well.
Yeah.
So, Representative Snyder, did you have other questions?
Just because it's been a bit since we've had this bill before us in this committee, I always find it helpful for one or two concrete examples relevant to Alaska that motivates whatever piece of legislation we're looking at. And if you could remind us of that, that would be helpful to me. Thank you.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Snyder, Vice Chair Snyder. So if I understand your question, why do we have this bill in front of us? Okay, thank you. So just a little bit of a history. My predecessor, Representative Samuels, actually had a bill to deal with the storage lien. We both had a neighbor who was an auctioneer, and he talked about some of the problems that were happening in this storage industry from his perspective and from his view. And so I did introduce a bill at that time. It was heavy on doing appraisals for a property before it was disposed of. But then talking to industry over the years, I realized that that's not really how things work. You know, and then also watching the storage war episodes, I don't even know what it's called, but watching people, how they look inside, they auction it off, and that's pretty much the procedures. So working with industry over the last few years, and this isn't the first time this bill has been introduced. It was introduced the latest time, I think it was 2018. And at that time, we had it pretty refined about where we're at today. And then now we have a little bit more clarity that was added to it with the help of the industry. And that's the reason why the bill is now before us. But I do want to explain that when we first introduced it back in 2011, 2012, that there was an example, a particular person, and we used this as an example, but as a real life example in the previous meeting hearing. And that was someone did have a lot of art that was stored in one of her storage units. And she lost all of that art, and she felt like she wasn't properly notified. There was a real problem. I think things got balled up in the courts over that. And so that was another reason why we saw it being imperative to have some sort of something in statutes to help define what is and what isn't and what can be done and what can't be done.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, along the line of notification on page 7, line 10 talks about the mailing requirements for notification. And it just came to me in how we're trying to offer concrete but flexible ways of communication. Has text or call been considered as a means of communication? Because I know just for myself, my own experience, that phone calls get so easily missed anymore, but a text is something visual. And I was wondering if that's something that has been considered, or by the National Association, as being another means of contacting the tenants.
And through the chair, Representative Vance, I know that this has been element has been discussed quite a bit, notification. The industry feels like that phone calls aren't you're not able to track that you made a phone call or record it. I think that if they just kept a log, that's okay, but they wanted to remove that section out because of how do they prove that they actually made the phone call. But no, text messaging was not hadn't been discussed. I think text messaging is a good idea as well, but as was pointed out in the previous meeting, that when you're out away from home, which is the reason why a lot of people do have storage units, and you're, for example, working out in rural Alaska, sometimes you just don't get those messages until you get in the phone range. And so I think both a text message and being able to check your voicemails, you can still check your voicemails remotely. Sometimes you can't check your text messages remotely. And so I'm okay with, text messaging is a great idea on trying to notify, but also allow the storage facility owners to have as much flexibility as possible in reaching out to people. And we heard a good example, I think, from a storage person in the Kenai Peninsula that I thought was very noble storage renter and really doing the best practices possible. And he shared with the committee on the ways that he tries reaching out to people. So I'm glad that there are storage owners that are making efforts to do so, but we've also seen in the past where storage owners haven't been, because of whatever guns or whatever items happen to be in storage facilities, and there's nothing that says that they need to dispose of that property. They can keep it for themselves.
Thank you.
I don't see other questions. Do you want to add something?
I just wanted to see if Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, if perhaps one of the invited testifiers would like to weigh in on whether they actually call and text their customers. Sharon Beeman and Elizabeth Mann are actual storage facility owners.
Anything to add, Ms.? I'll start with Ms. Beeman. Anything to add in terms of calling or texting?
Was it my name, Elizabeth Mann?
You can go ahead, Ms. Mann. You're on the phone. Go ahead. You can answer the question.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Yes, we do all of the above, emailing, calling, texting. We mail out letters. Eventually, we mail out a certified letter at 90 days. Depending on the program that you use, there are tracking softwares that are offered. So with Storable, they will track the calls coming in and out, and they will track the text messaging. But we do have cell phones in our office, and that's our last step as we try to text someone, because we do understand that, you know, a customer may not be updating their email address with us, their mailing address, and that's our last hope to let them know that we are selling their items.
Ms. Beeman, anything to contribute to the discussion about texting and phoning?
Yes, we do the same. We call when about 5 to 6 days after their rent is late, and then in 21 days, we send out two notices, one certified, one regular mail. And then 30 days after that is when the units go up for auction. My concern about the language in this bill is that on page 7, line 12, says, call the unit renter and mail the notice to the unit renter's postal address, electronic mail. In here, it states that we need to do that, or we need to make a call every single time we send out a notice. And because we send out a couple of notices before we auction the unit, I personally don't see any sense in making a call every single time we send out a notice. We email the notices when they're late. We email when we cut their lock, and another time before the auction. I think calling is frankly it's a waste of everyone's time when they're not going to answer in the first place. And so my question is, what happened to personal responsibility? They also need to take on that responsibility of contacting us when they know that they're late, because it's stipulated in the lease that they sign.
Thank you. Ms. Mann, when I asked you earlier, you said you had some concerns with the legislation. Why don't you share your concerns with the legislation that you referenced earlier?
Yes, and it does
to keep our record, identify yourself before you start talking.
Oh, Elizabeth Mann with Alaska Mini Storage.
Please proceed.
Okay, so this does tie into what my concern is, and I do agree with the lady that just spoke before me. There should be some type of responsibility to update credit cards with us, email addresses, mailing addresses and such. So I agree with that. But the section that I'd like to touch on is section 3435600, self-storage facility liens, on page 2. And this is the monthly late fees to not exceed $20 or 20% of the monthly rental fee. So that's something that we have a big problem with. So capping that doesn't even begin to cover the, you know, hourly wages that some of these employees get paid. Some of them live on site. And so, like I just stated, all of the steps that we have to take to contact these customers that are going late, and that can include, you know, the auctions that can take up to 2-3 hours, depending on how many units we have, and cutting their locks off and all of the steps that they have to take. So we would much rather be paying our employees to promote our business, clean up our sites, patrol our sites, address maintenance issues, and conduct move-ins and move-outs like they regularly should be. So I feel like if our late fees are not, you know, high enough to stop them from going late over and over again or going down the path of going to lien status, there's really nothing they're going to be afraid of. You know, if it's $20 every single month up until 120 days, maybe that wouldn't be that big of a deal to them. So that doesn't match what we have right now. We don't want our customers to go late, and we believe it's important to have late charges that reflect that feeling and that policy. So that's my first concern. I don't know if you want me to go on to the next one.
You can go to the next one.
Okay. So the next section has to do with vehicles. So section 34, 35, 645, redemption by unit renter, vehicle owner, or vehicle lien holder on page 5. So we also disagree with this. Once the unit is past 120 days at our site, we do not find it our responsibility to explore the title holder or lien holder. We also do not explore the unit. If we can visibly see that there are items that look stolen or there's firearms, we do address that with the police force. But otherwise, our practice is to impound a vehicle using a third-party company. That impound company is regulated to provide reporting to the owner, if they can be identified, of course. We would like to see clear language that allows us to continue this practice. We would not be able to recover the employee's time and expenses once again, trying to locate or identify an owner or lien holder. We do not auction off units with vehicles, so that's not even our practice. The tow company is the responsible party thereafter, after the 120 days. So for us, the bottom line is we don't want our tenants to go late, and we'll do whatever we can to prevent that. And at no point are we profiting from late fees or auctions. And I believe the owner of Blue Moose Storage expressed that last time, and I completely agree with that. We're not coming out on top here. So I think that we should be protected in that sense completely. But we do believe that there's value in this house bill to protect tenants and the owners of, you know, Alaska storage facilities. And we are the last state that doesn't have this. I was at a convention in Vegas last year, and all of the law classes, nothing pertained to us. And it was very apparent that the statutes that are listed right now on the state website, it's not enough to cover the operations that go on in Alaska as far as facilities go. So
I'll raise the question. I've talked with the bill sponsor about this as well. I would expect to see a bill like this come as a consumer protection bill brought by consumers, basically the renters coming in and saying, we've been treated horribly by these storage unit owners. And so what seems a little bit kind of interesting to me is that the people that are here saying, give us regulation, are the actual owners that seem, at least the ones that are testifying, are saying that they want to be regulated. And the libertarian side of me thinks, why would you want to be regulated? Why don't you just write contracts and provide consumers the rights that they demand? And if they're happy and they don't complain, because I haven't had anybody come to me in my legislative capacity saying, I don't, you mean storage unit owners are treating me poorly. I even rent a storage unit in Juneau for stuff when I leave Juneau, and I find them treating me just fine. So I guess that's kind of the question is why are the owners so interested in this if the consumers seem to be pretty happy with the service they're receiving, at least if getting complaints from consumers is a gauge that isn't hitting the radar screen. Not sure who would like to respond to that, but that's one of the questions I have. And I know I've shared this with Representative Tuck. I know they've shared this with you before, but I just want to hear your perspective or potentially from Ms. Beeman or Ms. Mann.
This is Ms. Mann again. Really, it'd be the same thing if there wasn't, you know, some type of bill for like the Tenant and Landlord Act, right? If I were a landlord and renting out my home, I would want some type of guideline to follow. This company has been in business for over 35 years. There's been a lot of learning curves. There's been learning curves since I've been on for 4 years. And especially with managing employees along with this too, giving them some type of basis to go off of as well is helpful. We do have a lot of customers that kind of ruffle their feathers at our contract, which actually is very in line with everything we have in here, aside from the few things that I have concerns about. And so it would be very nice when I get told I'm going to send you to court, I can pull something out and have a little bit of backing for myself besides just my contract.
I see Representative Kirka has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would express the same kind of, question as the chairman. I can understand the concern, but it seems odd to me that somebody would want or they would need, in terms of just good policy or good business practice, would need the government to tell them how to run the business. It's very surprising to me. I recall when I think the first hearing we had on this bill, and there was the basis was that there's not anything in the law for this. And I'm looking at this bill, it's pretty extensive. We're adding a lot of new language. But it seems to me that if there's any holes in this issue of renting storage space in the law that really need to be addressed, it could be addressed maybe in a small addition to the contract law, or I think the testifier mentioned the Landlord-Tenant Act. It seems like this is kind of overkill and overregulation. If there are indeed – because I've never heard of egregious – I've never – like the chair, I've never heard of people complaining about how they're being treated by landlords when it comes to storage.
This is Mrs. Beeman. I've extensively looked over the bill that's being presented, and I've also looked over the lien law for North Dakota. This bill is, what I have in my hands is 9 pages long, and the one from North Dakota is simply 4 pages. It's very simplistic, but it does cover everything. I still have concerns about a few things in this bill. I concur with Ms. Mann regarding the section about the vehicles, and I hear what she said. Her facility does not allow vehicles in the units. However, we do allow that. And this section that says that a lien holder can pay for only part of the storage unit in order to get the vehicle out is frankly unrealistic and totally it's just not practical to divide a unit into square feet and have somebody pay for part of it when the unit itself is in arrears. It's just convoluted and unrealistic and unenforceable. So there are things in this nine-page bill that it seems to make our jobs more difficult. And, you know, I agree that we do need some sort of protection and clarification on things if we did have to go to court. But, like I said, I think I personally think the bill could be a little more simplified. Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I mean, sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You got the wrong room.
In the wrong position. Thank you very much. You know, this we were trying to strike a balance with this. And in testifying, what we heard in testimony from a previous meeting was that North Dakota was the best law for self-storage associations. And they said that the worst one for self-storage is Rhode Island. And I don't know what size Rhode Island has in comparison, but we're trying to strike a balance with this. I don't know on the towing of the vehicle by a third party, how do you then get your money back from that? What we try to do with this, these section is allowing the lien holder to be able to get their money back on that vehicle. And one of the ways that you can do, one of the reasons why we have title stuff in here is so they can have access to that title, so they know if there's any other lien holders on there, and that they can have priority over that when they get the possession of that property and they're able to monetize that property. I don't know how that works, and if they don't mind explaining how it works once they go to a third-party towing company, if they're able to do the same thing, if they're able to still auction that off and still be able to get their money back. But that was the goal for this section of the bill, was to make sure the lien holder was able to capture money back.
Question for Ms. Beeman or Ms. Mann. Well, actually, I'll start with Ms. Beeman, and then I'll ask the same question, Ms. Mann. Ms. Beeman, what are the circumstances under which you, the owner of the storage units, as opposed to the renter, what are the circumstances under which you currently bring the renter to court?
We've never had to take a storage unit renter to court. Swallow our losses.
Probably somewhat on the old adage that it's hard to get blood from a stone.
It's that philosophy, along with the fact that attorneys are about $300 an hour, and it's just cheaper for us to swallow that bill. We have an office policy that if a vehicle is late and their fees have reached $500, then we start the process to auction the vehicle.
And Ms. Mann,
we do go through that process of finding out the owner and the lien holder, but when we have a vehicle parked on our property, we require the registration of the vehicle. So we take a copy of that.
Thank you very much. Ms. Mann, what's your experience? How often has your company, in the time you've been working there, actually as an owner brought a renter to court?
We never have as well.
Oh, and I want to note that Representative Eastman joined us at 1:39 p.m. He's on teleconference. Ms. Mann, did I cut you off accidentally?
Oh, that's okay, sir.
Did you have anything more? Or was that everything?
So we also send balances to collections. I just wanted to state that as well. We don't get all of our money back still, but we also have parking outside. And for those units, we know who the owner is of the vehicle. We know we have the insurance and all of that on it.
we get that still towed off, but the balance that remains on their account, whether or not they're parked inside a unit or out on the lot, we still send that amount to collections.
Thank you. Other questions from members of the committee? Representative Kirka.
Looking here on page, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, looking in here on page 6, I guess it's section 35660C, after a lot of the, I guess the, any leftover value from disposing of the contents of a storage unit, that we're saying here that the property owner, landlord, has to hold on to the rent, the proceeds. I guess it's a very unlikely scenario from what I'm hearing in reality, that they have to hold on to the proceeds for a whole year, just in case the, I guess, the original owner shows up to claim the proceeds. I'm just kind of wondering what was the thought behind that and if that's reasonable.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka.
I was going to ask him who he wants to hear from, so Representative Tuck.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, thank you. So, yeah, I mean, this basically allows someone that may have had a medical condition and weren't able to pay their bills or became incapacitated in some way, but it allows them to, any excess money from the sale of their property, be able to be claimed up to a year. After that, they have no claim to it any longer.
Okay, let's go off record for a minute. So we're back on record. While we were off record, I had a discussion with both the bill sponsor and members of the committee about kind of an approach to go forward. And it sounds like there's a general preference that what we do is that, that Representative Tuck has taken a lot of notes about various comments from folks both on the committee and folks that have testified about potential changes to the bill and suggested modifications. And it sounds like our plan to go forward, rather than set an amendment deadline today, we'll just let Representative Tuck come up with some of the proposed changes and circulate that with the committee, and then the committee can get back to him. And then our goal would be over the next period of time, come up with a CS that reflects both committee preferences as well as some of the comments that we've heard from people like Ms. Gotta look at my script, Ms. Beeman and Ms. Hall, Ms. Mann, to kind of make sure that we incorporate a variety of these different concerns, and then we can, once we've done all that, we can get a CS proposed and bring that back in front of the committee. So if that works for everybody, it looks like it does. Any other questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor or any of the people online? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to hold the bill for further review. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, April 22nd at 1 p.m. As I mentioned last week, if anyone is considering an amendment to Senate Bill 7, please let our office know and submit those amendments electronically by 5 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, April 21st. And with that, we're going to stand adjourned. The time is now 1:47 p.m.